So I'm going to tell a story about my first powwow. Now, I didn't know what a powwow was. A powwow is a celebration of Indian culture, of tribes culture. I had never been to one, and I was going to go to the Red Lake Reservation, which is a very actually poor reservation. I think it's probably one of the poorest places in Minnesota, and it's about 6 hours north of the Twin Cities. And to prepare, I sat with Peggy Flanagan, who is half Ojibwe. She grew up in the same suburb I grew up in, which is St. Louis Park. So Peggy was my advisor on Indian affairs, and she's now the lieutenant governor of Minnesota, and she's unbelievably great. So I sat down with her, and I said, okay, well, you know, she knew what it was. I was going to this powwow at the Red Lake, and I knew nothing about it. And she said, okay, first thing, don't dance. I said, don't dance. She said, yeah, don't dance. I said, why don't I dance? And she said, Governor Pawlenty danced a couple years ago, and they haven't stopped making fun of him. So don't dance. I go, don't dance. Okay, I got it. Don't dance. So she said, okay, so now what this is a celebration of the culture. And they will enter the circle. It's a circle, a dirt circle. There'll be bleachers around it in a circle. And there'll be drums on the outside. People will be drumming. And they dance around the circle, and don't dance. I said, okay, don't dance. And she said, now, they're wearing regalia. It's regalia. Don't say costumes. They're wearing their regalia. Okay, I got it. Regalia, don't dance. Okay, I got it. She said, okay, leading off, the first ones out will be the warriors. They'll have their regalia, but they'll also have their hat, their veteran's hat. And American Indians volunteer for military service more than any other minority group in the country. I said, really? I did not know that. Well, now you know it. Maybe someone will have a World War II cap, maybe, but there'll definitely be Korea. There'll be Vietnam. There'll be the Gulf Wars. So they lead off because they are the warriors. And then the rest of the people will come out, and they'll dance around, and don't dance. I said, I got it. Don't dance. So that'll go on for, I don't know, like a half hour, 45 minutes. Then they'll stop, and then the chairman of the tribe will introduce you, and you'll speak. And I go, okay. So she said, what are you going to say? And I hadn't really given this a lot of thought, so I said, well, I think I'll talk about how American Indians have been underfunded, and there's been a lot of trauma, and there are a lot of pathologies, and that hasn't fully funded education and health care. And she said, yeah, they'll have heard that. And I go, okay, well, she said, they're going to expect you to be funny. And I said, well, we're trying to get away from that in this campaign. You know, she goes, I know, they're going to expect you to be funny. So I said, okay. So, thanks, Peggy. She says, don't dance. So we drive up there next day. It's a six-hour drive, and I'm thinking, I'm nervous now. And Peggy couldn't come, and I kind of felt nervous about that. So I get there, and it's about dusk, and the thing is about to start, and the drumming starts, and out come the warriors. They're dancing in this circle. I'm standing right outside the edge of the circle. About 4 or 5 minutes into it, a guy kind of dances up to me and then dances in place and says, why don't you come in and dance? And I say, well, maybe later, maybe later. And then he says, we'll respect you more if you dance. And I said, well, you know, I might have. Yeah. Okay, so now the dance continues. So then Buck Jourdain, the chairman of Red Lake, you know, introduces me, says he's a friend. That helps a little bit, I think. And then he gives me the mic. I start saying, federal government hasn't met its treaty obligations, and education is underfunded, and health care is underfunded, not according to the treaty. And they're, like, staring at me. Like, yeah, we've heard that, you know. And I go, I said, I got to try to figure out something here. So I said, you know, every group in America celebrates its culture. You know, for example, I'm Jewish. Silence. And I say, let me try that again. I'm Jewish. And they cheer and applaud and laugh. I go, oh, thank God I got him a little bit. And Jews love to celebrate our culture like you are today. But speaking of education, Americans need to know that Native Americans are a contemporary people. You're a contemporary people with contemporary problems and contemporary assets. And they're going with me. Now they like me. Now they're going. So I get cocky. And I go, you know, a gentleman asked me to dance. I will make you a deal. I will dance if you will agree not to make fun of me afterwards. They laugh. And I say, so I need everybody here to raise your hand and agree not to make fun of me after I dance. And so raise your hands. And about two-thirds raise their hand. I go, that's not enough. I need everybody here to raise your hand in order for me to dance. And then everyone raises their hand. And I'm going like, man, I did it. What a brilliant thing I just did. And then one of the drummers hits his drum. And another drummer starts hitting their drum. And all the drummers are drumming, and everyone is laughing. And now I have to dance alone in front of everyone. And I went, how did you do this to yourself? How did you manage to get yourself into this situation? And they're howling. I had no choice. And fortunately, I had watched how people dance. And it's kind of a shuffle, to like with your left foot, two shuffles, right foot, two shuffle. And I start dancing the circle, you know, counterclockwise. And I'm going like, you idiot, you idiot. And they're laughing, and I can't even look at anybody. I'm just, like, looking at my feet. I get about a quarter of the way around the circle, and a little, I don't know, four-year-old, five-year-old girl comes out to bail me out. And she grabs my hand, and she dances with me. And then another kid comes out, and another kid. And now I'm dancing with 10 kids. And then everyone else starts coming in. And it's unbelievably beautiful. I become a dancing fool. And then this woman comes up to me, and she says to me, you dance like a white guy. And I said, well, wait, what about the agreement not to make fun of me? She said, no, the agreement was not to make fun of you after you leave. So I said, you're right. And it was quite a beautiful evening. Later, Buck Jourdain, the chairman, said, I'd like you to meet my son. He's in the parking lot with his friend who's in the Army. So I go out and I see their young men leaning up against this car, this old car. I talked to them and I said, you're in the Army. He said, well, I was in the Army, but I had to leave. I said, why? He said, well, I can't see very well. And I said, well, you're not wearing glasses. And he said, well, they were supposed to make me glasses, but they didn't. And I said, well, what's wrong with your eyesight? And he said, I don't know. And I said, haven't you gone to the eye doctor? And he said, oh, we don't have an eye doctor. So one of the things when I got to the Senate was work on Indian health care, and they have a doctor now, or at least it did last time I checked. You never know in Indian country. But that was a great experience. My guest today is Karen Diver. Karen is a friend. She's been a friend since 2007 when I started running. I met her 2 days after I announced that I was running for the Senate. She was the first chairwoman of the Fond du Lac Band of the Ojibwe, before there had been chairman. Fond du Lac is part of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. During the Obama administration, Karen served in the White House as special assistant to the president in Native Affairs. As a member of the Domestic Policy Council staff, she advised President Obama on issues impacting Indian country. Karen, thanks for joining us. You are in a studio in Duluth, Minnesota.
Enjoying the fine Minnesota winter.
That's where we first met. What happened was I had announced for the Senate 2 days prior, and then I came up to Duluth, and we met at the casino there in Duluth, right?
Yep, in our boardroom.
In your boardroom. Do you remember saying to me, why are you here?
I vaguely recall that, Al.
Okay, you said, why are you here? Usually we only see politicians about a month before the election. And I said, I'm here because I want to learn about Native Americans because I don't know anything. I practically know nothing. And Paul Wellstone was on Indian Affairs, and I want to be on Indian Affairs.
I pointed you to the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development, which is housed within the Kennedy School of Government and had spent 30 years studying what best practices look like in governance in Indian tribes. And all of their research by these fancy Harvard researchers says that when tribes are self-determined and given the tools, namely that the federal government lives up to its responsibility, but when they take those, whether it's financial resources or regulations that really allow them to flourish in their own self-determination, that that's actually what is most impactful for positive outcomes for tribal governments and tribal peoples.
Okay. I went back to Minneapolis like a couple days later because I was going up to the range and over northern Minnesota. And I read the study, and then I called you up.
I do remember this one.
Yeah. And you were surprised.
I was, Al, because I wasn't used to people saying that they were going to do something in government and actually doing it thoroughly and swiftly and reporting back that positive outcome. So to this day, I give you credit for that, for being earnest in your desire to learn more.
What I learned very quickly when I finally got there, which took a while, was that Native Americans don't expect the federal government they don't expect much of anything. Is that fair to say?
Hope springs eternal. I think that that is a part of the resiliency of the indigenous people of the United States. Practice and history lead us to not have high expectations. So when we do find allies, it's always a breath of fresh air.
I very, very quickly found out that when I was in the Indian Affairs Committee, there were a few things about that. And one was those who testified in front of us from Indian country, had very low expectations of what we as a committee would do. And that Indian Affairs Committee was a low priority committee. What I did experience was that the Democrats on the committee showed up, and there were a couple Republicans on the Indian Affairs Committee. At the end of a session or end of a Congress, you have a picture taken of the whole committee. And there were a couple of Republicans on the committee who I did not know were on the committee until they took the damn picture. So that gives you some idea of the attention paid. I want to talk about the basic relationship between the federal government and tribes, and that is the trust doctrine. It is an obligation to provide services that ensure survival and welfare of Indian tribes. The purpose is to promote those economic and social programs which are necessary to raise the standard of living and social well-being of the Indian people to a level comparable to the non-Indian society. Have we achieved that?
We have not achieved that. You look at any of the various social indicators around tribal peoples, there are some tribes who have done quite well for themselves, mainly because they've undertaken economic development activities and have the ability to fund their own service delivery and provide employment and raise the economic level of their communities. What we find, though, is that doesn't always overcome 250, 300 years of social deficits and assimilationist strategies and trauma from federal policies. And what you're talking about, that trust responsibility was defined by what we call the Marshall Trilogy. Chief Justice John Marshall of the Supreme Court in the 1800s had some seminal Indian law cases that define that Native peoples and tribes were to the federal government, that it was like a parent to a ward, or like foster children of the federal government. And the basis of all of that was language in the treaties and the obligation of the federal government that they chose in treaties to undertake when those treaties were signed.
Let's talk a little bit or somewhat about the history in terms of the odd ways in which the federal government exercised those responsibilities.
Well, probably most timely for your listeners is the Trail of Tears, where they actually chose to abrogate those treaties and take back treaty reserve lands and march five tribes
Jackson.
To Oklahoma. That's, yeah, Jackson. And it was genocide. Fully a fourth, I believe, of the people along that journey to Oklahoma from eastern states died along the way. We can take the assimilationist policies of the boarding school era from the mid-1800s up until the 1970s, where one-third of Native American children were taken from their parents and put in boarding schools where their language was forbidden, their culture, access to their families, and where, you know, severe trauma to their person. We know that there was high rates of physical and sexual abuse in those locations of those children who were removed from their parents. And those were sanctioned by the federal government and run by the federal government, as well as some of the proselytizing faiths at the time. So, I mean, those were the two most egregious, although isolationist activities were as simple as saying that you had to have permission to leave the reservation in order to travel and see family or things like that. So, you know, the reservations weren't free from federal oversight in any way. It wasn't like tribes were left alone to mind their own business on their remaining homelands. There was active management for nefarious purposes by the federal government.
I want to talk a little bit the Bago Ganeshig School. Had you been to the Bago Ganeshig School at Leech Lake before it was rebuilt finally?
No, but I had conversations with leadership at Leech Lake about the condition of their school, which by any accounts was abysmal.
It really was, and I visited a number of times and fought for it being rebuilt. And basically, it was what's called a pole barn, and it was made of tin. It leaked. The kids had to wear their winter clothes and wrap themselves in blankets to be in school. There were rats. There was mold. The floors weren't level. This is what struck me. As bad as everything was, the library was basically the size, like a middle-sized closet with two bookshelves. And the bookshelves were not full. So for years, we fought to get this school rebuilt. And finally, I'd bring it up to Sally Jewell. You must know Sally. She was the Interior Secretary, and the Interior Secretary is in charge of all Indian matters. Anytime I would see her, I would say, you got to go to the Bhagwat Ganeshik School. And finally, one day she did. She goes there, and she had an appointment later in the day in Duluth, and she didn't go because she saw how awful the physical condition of the school was. Then we got the funding. So last summer, I was there for the opening of the school, and I went to the library. The librarian told me they could have 14,000 books in the library. So I got the idea in my head that wouldn't it be great if all the different tribes in the country could send a history of their tribe, if they have one, to Leech Lake so it could be a repository of all these histories. And that was the first idea I got, okay? So I've done that. I've sent a letter to all the tribes. But then I was talking to somebody. I consulted with a lot of people on this. And I think you'll vouch for this observation, that many of the histories that are written of the tribes, for most kids, are long and boring. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that not even adults pay good enough attention to history, let alone children.
Yeah, and I realize sort of, the idea of a school library is to get kids interested in reading and to have fun reading. So my first notion was fine, and we're beginning to get these histories and also history of the cultural histories and books written by Native authors, and that's part of what I'm trying to do. But then I call Louise Urich, who has a bookstore in Minneapolis, who's a Native author, and started consulting with people. And what I've done is assembled, with the input of a number of librarians, the librarian at Leech Lake, a number of Native authors, a number of other groups, to put together a comprehensive list of books that these kids should have. And I have a website, alfranken.com, and people can go to that, and it's like a wedding register. You can look at the books, and you can buy Huck Finn. You know, if you want to buy Huck Finn, or if you want to buy a book about the Ojibwe or Navajo or drumming or any history at all or cultural thing at all. So I want to send people there to alfranken.com.
That sounds great. And there's also this Twitter feed called Native American Literature and Culture. What I like about that list is it also has contemporary authors so that young people can read not just a historical accounting of their folks, but they continue to see themselves as a modern day people and their place in the world today, which is also super important for young people to see themselves reflected contemporarily.
Very often, the only coverage of Indian events is the powwow, where there's regalia, but Indians are a contemporary people, and as are Jews, we're a contemporary people. Did you know that, Karen?
I did know that, Al.
Yeah. But Karen, you have been a public servant of the greatest quality. Thank you for your service to Fond du Lac, to Native Americans nationwide and to our country.
Thank you for your service as well, Al. Much appreciated and missed.
All right, Karen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Bye.